London elects its first Muslim mayor, and he's not holding back in his comments about our U.S. election. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now video on demand with our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, we'll tell you why the mayors of Paris and London are denouncing Donald Trump this morning. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, medical news on the First Coast. Hope for heart patients thanks to advances at Baptist Health. Plus, it's a new chapter for the city's Cummer Museum. All of that and more ahead. But first, this hour, reaction continues to pour in around the world over the news that London has elected its first ever Muslim mayor. Sadiq Khan, the London-born son of Pakistani immigrants, was elected last week in London by a wide margin after a campaign that saw his conservative rival Zach Goldsmith accuse him of having shared platforms with Islamic extremists. Now, Khan today is joining with the mayor of Paris in a scathing rebuke of Donald Trump over his call to ban Muslims entering the U.S., and also Trump's suggestion that he would make an exception for Mayor Khan. Mr. Khan says he plans to visit the U.S. before November in case Trump becomes president. This is generating a lot of discussion. Here to give his thoughts is Dr. Parvez Ahmed of UNF and the city's Human Rights Commission, a frequent writer and commentator about the American Muslim experience. Dr. Ahmed, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And we want your calls right now. What are your thoughts about London's first ever Muslim mayor and his remarks about Donald Trump? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us or weigh in on our Facebook page. And so Sadiq Khan is a former human rights lawyer and a member of England's Labour Party, winning this election decisively in London and generating headlines around the world.
Yeah, in my view, it's a remarkable election. It is almost as remarkable as the election of the first black man to become the president of the United States, because the stories have uncanny parallels to each other. Both Barack Obama and Sadiq Khan are lawyers. Their wives are also lawyers. They both met their wives while working as colleagues in a law firm. Both have two young daughters. Both were accused of palling around with terrorists, and against heavy odds, they beat back a dog whistle campaign that was laced with racism and Islamophobia. So it's kind of remarkable. And what I find this remarkable is when you put it in the in a little bit of a more broader context, you have seen that repeatedly when campaigns have used anti-Muslim sentiments or anti-Muslim rhetoric to fire up their base and try to win an election. By and large, those efforts have been defeated in many, many places. We saw this very recently in Canada. The current Prime Minister of Canada, he was accused of supporting Muslims and being soft on Muslims and terrorists and stuff like that. And he beat back that campaign and won quite decisively. In England, we have seen this. And in many other places, we see this. And yet, this tactic keeps on being tried, including in the current presidential election cycle. And I'm hoping that our country will follow the lead of London and Canada and do the right thing again.
We want your calls at 549-2937 about this topic. What are your thoughts about the new London mayor, Sadiq Khan, joining with the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, denouncing Donald Trump? Khan said he wants the world to know that it's possible to be Western and Muslim at the same time. The message is, this is the best of humanity, the best of the West. And he said his message to Donald Trump is that he would visit the U.S. before the November election in case Donald Trump wins. At the same time, the mayor of Paris said, Mr. Trump is so stupid.
Well, I mean, if you look at Donald Trump's proposal of banning Muslims from coming to this country, it is a very ill-thought-out proposition that unfortunately has 60-70% support from his voters or the Republican base. It is ill-thought-out at many levels. First of all, the proposal is probably most likely unconstitutional. We do not put a religious test on any public law, and this would clearly put that religious test. The second part of it is that how do you enforce this law? Every visitor that comes into this country, so with somebody in the border, would have to check their religion. How do you check a person's religion? Third is that it will have consequences if this ban ever goes through. It will obviously have unintended consequences in many ways. Other countries may be forced to follow suit by banning Americans from visiting their country. Their governments will come under popular pressure. It will actually give voice to extremists. It can destabilize governments in other countries, and it can possibly create a trade war. So a proposal that is so crass and so ill thought out, the fact that it's receiving such widespread support among the electorate is a moment of concern that everybody should pause and rethink. Is this really where we want our country to go?
We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Mr. Khan won the election handily over his opponent, Zach Goldsmith, who accused him of being too cozy with Islamic extremists in Britain. At the same time, during the campaign, it was discovered that in 2009, Sadiq Khan used a racially divisive term, Uncle Tom, on Iranian state television to describe reforming liberal Muslims who counter extremism within their own community. As he assumes the mantle of mayor of London, it would be fair to assume that those types of criticisms of alleged ties he has to extremists in Europe might continue. What are your thoughts about that piece of his campaign and his platform?
Well, I'm not here to defend Sadiq Khan because I really do not know the man personally or have not followed the campaign. But I think the fact that all those allegations were out there during the campaign trail and the voters of London decisively on the second ballot by a 57% margin, 57 to 30, some 40%, something like that, margin elected him, tells you that he was vetted for all of these comments that he made, and the voters did not find them to be a hindrance to his candidacy, and mostly that the fact that he will be an effective mayor for their city. So ultimately, these kind of things have come up during other elections, including our own election in 2008. You remember, then Senator Obama was described as palling around with terrorists, and the public looked at those allegations and they did not find anything credible about them.
We want your calls right now as the new mayor of London denounces presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump. 549-2937. Lots of calls already. Sam in Jacksonville. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well, Melissa. Good morning, to you and Dr. Ahmed. When I turned on the radio and heard that had been the first Muslim elected mayor of London, and actually said yes.
Hey, we're having trouble hearing you, Sam.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
A little bit better.
Okay. Okay. I'm overjoyed to hear that this has happened. My family is from Lanka, and I think that my family used to live in England back in the 70s and 80s, and they experienced a lot of racism. It's good to know how much England, well, not England necessarily, because London is very different. It's good to know how London progressed.
All right, thanks for the call. And is London different from the rest of the country?
Well, it certainly is. There's a higher percentage of minority population in London than the rest of the country. And just like any big city, just like New York is different over here than the rest of the country in terms of its diversity, in terms of its more progressive attitude towards diversity, the same will hold true for London. But what is interesting, I want to comment over here a little bit, Sadiq Khan's election is important not just from the political side of it, but there is a huge social ramification to his election. He interrupts a very dangerous narrative that has been repeatedly put forward about Muslims in Europe, particularly in Europe, but in general about Muslims in the West, America, Europe, and other places. And the narrative is that the Muslims are not integrating into society, that they're isolated from society. And Sadiq Khan interrupts that narrative. He shows a Muslim, as he mentions, that you can be a Muslim and a citizen of your country, whether it's America or Great Britain or anywhere else. And you can be successful in both. Both those identities are important to you, just as it would be important for a Christian to be a Christian and be an American or be a European. It would be important for a Muslim to be a Muslim and be a European or an American. So he interrupts that, and he provides with an unparalleled opportunity. Sadiq Khan is the worst nightmare for people who support ISIS, because he interrupts their propaganda that there is a war against Islam by Western countries. He interrupts that propaganda. He clearly shows that the people in the West are not anti-Muslim. By and large, when given a fair choice, as in this election, people support it. They did not support Sadiq Khan because he was a Muslim. They supported Sadiq Khan because he was a good candidate for mayor. He happens to be a Muslim.
What are your thoughts about the election of Sadiq Khan in London and his comments about our presidential election? 549-2937. Ryan in Palm Coast this morning. Hi, Ryan. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
Well, you know, I am, first of all, I'm not a Trump supporter, and I think his main thing about not letting anyone in, it's this 10,000 refugees from Syria, and in remark to the new London mayor, he integrates into society because he's a college-educated man, he's an attorney, his wife is the same. These 10,000 refugees are uneducated for the most part. We're talking about Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria. These are the uneducated masses. They're not assimilating into the country. They're living in their own societies. These are the same people that carried out the attacks in Paris, the refugees that came in with some other extras. This is what we don't need in this country. We don't need more uneducated people that aren't going to become part of society.
That's Ryan in Palm Coast.
Well, first of all, the people who carried out the attacks in Paris and Belgium were citizens of those countries. They were not refugees. And the second is that many of the refugees who are fleeing Syria are also highly, highly educated. In fact, that's one of the reasons countries in Europe like Germany and others are welcoming those refugees, because they are a net gain to their society. They're bringing in highly skilled workers, highly educated workers, without the country actually having to spend a lot of money on them. And smart countries recognize that. The third point is that the refugee resettlement process in the U.S. is the most stringent immigration process that exists in this country. It takes 18 months to 2 years for a refugee to get through that process, and they go through multiple level of security checks. So also the data bears out that of the tens and thousands of refugees, not just recently, but over a very long period of history that have resettled into the U.S., not a single one has carried out a terrorist attack.
It's unfortunate that when, say, there's a domestic attack by, say, a white Christian male, not every white Christian man in America is expected to stand up and collectively denounce each and every one of those violent incidents.
Let
me just continue.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, because of the dynamics of what we're seeing, the attacks in Paris, San Bernardino, California, and others, you are often in this community put in the unfair position of having to stand up and denounce extremism, even though you have nothing to do with it, and of course you don't agree with it. And so, all of that said, because so many Americans see this issue through the prism of the extremist violent incidents that they've heard about or seen on the news, what would you say to those watching right now and listening right now who say, yes, it's great that this mayor's been elected, but I'm still very afraid of another terrorist act, either domestically or if, say, I travel abroad?
No, I think we should always be concerned, because the threat of terrorism is real. But we also have to have a realistic assessment of that threat. If you look at objective studies, it would tell you that the chances of any one of us dying from a terrorist incident is lower than us dying from a lightning strike. And that's reality too. But somehow it does not factor into our perception. The other part is that there is this human tendency that anytime somebody does bad who is not part of my group, I tend to look at that bad and ascribe it to the other group. But if anybody does bad from my group, I tend to say, well, that's just a one-off incident.
A lone wolf.
Yeah, the Charleston incident happened, and most people would say, well, that's just a one-off incident. Nobody is going to incriminate all of the right-wing parties in this country, all of the right-wing militia movements in this country because of Charleston. So that's kind of the problem that we are facing. I have repeatedly said this. To solve the problem of terrorism, if we look at this as an us versus them problem, then we are all going to lose. It is an us and us problem. We have to collectively work together to figure out a solution to this without pointing of fingers of blame to people who are innocent and people who are just going about their lives to just do the right thing as other people are doing in their own communities.
Let's go now to Maria in Jacksonville. Hi, Maria.
Hi. I think it's strange that the elected him over there. Here in this country, I've done a lot of phone banking, and I've spoken to people who have lived through Nazi Germany, and they say Trump reminds them of exactly how Hitler took over Nazi Germany right now. And there are forces in our country behind this, and we are either one or none. We have to stand up to this. We are a country of immigrants, and we should not allow what our government is doing. We are one or none. Thank you.
Okay. On this program some weeks ago, you made some similar comments and took quite a bit of criticism for them. Mm-hmm. Do you stand by those comments? Do you still see Donald Trump as a proto-fascist in his rhetoric?
I do. If you look at the following that he has created, it is almost like a cultish type following, because he himself said that I can stand in the middle of the Fifth Street and shoot a person and my supporters will still line up behind me. He proposes ideas that he contradicts himself. He's arguing with himself on many of his ideas, and yet he has millions of people supporting him. And, you know, that's you're essentially trying to support a candidate based on their personality, not on any idea, not on any policy platform, and certainly not on any experience. This idea that he's a great businessman and that would translate into great government service or great political leader does not bear out. The last time we elected a person who was a great business leader, president of the country, it was George W. Bush, who also came from a great business background. And how did that work out? By the time George W. Bush left office, he had one of the lowest ratings of any U.S. president. So the idea that a great business leader translates into a great politician, great public servant, fundamentally misses the point that the objective of business and the objective of government are very, very different.
What would you say to Trump supporters who do have skepticism about his temperament and some of his policies, but they like the fact that he is perceived to be very, very strong in terms of his stance on Islamic terrorism, in terms of his stance on illegal immigration, and also the third one, his stance on trade and American jobs being outsourced. What would you say to Trump supporters who are so angry and fearful about all of those things, and they're supporting him not because they think he's a demagogue, but because they perceive that America, in their view, needs to be stronger?
No, I understand that, and I feel that frustration myself. And I think we are all disappointed in the way our governments, whether they're state, local, or federal government, has acted and sometimes been unable to improve our lives at our level. That frustration is real, and I acknowledge that because I am part of that frustrated group of people. But when we channel that frustration, the question we have to ask is that it is not enough to be frustrated. It is more important to ask the question, is this the person who has the temperament, who has the skills, and the life experience to actually give voice, not just give voice to my frustration, but actually do something about my frustration. So in terms of trade, as a business professor, I can tell you something a little bit about this issue of trade. The world is globalized. The idea that, you know, for example, Trump keeps on talking about he's going to tell Korea to not relocate their jobs. How? How does a U.S. president tell a company not to move their business if they choose to? Now, you can do this through tariffs. But if you impose tariffs, the people you hurt are the very people you're trying to help. because tariffs would increase the cost of the product. It will engage in trade war. So you may help some people by putting on tariffs, but you will hurt many more people because the people who are benefiting from free trade would also lose their job. It is an ill-thought-out idea. At the same time, I am also skeptical about the way the free trade has been applied. So there are many things about the free trade, whether it's NAFTA or TPP or any of these other trade deals, that certainly requires a thoughtful discussion. But it is not an either I accept everything or I reject everything proposal. There are things that have to be carefully discussed, carefully argued, and they're on the margins, they can be adjusted. But it is not an all or nothing proposal.
Clark in St. Augustine. Hey, Clark. Good morning. You're on the air.
It's Mark down here, but I just
sorry about that. We got a typo here. Go ahead, Mark.
Nope, no problem. I was just kind of curious, and I might have misunderstood, and I haven't been keeping up with the mayoral election in London, but it seems that if the Mayor Khan made a comment on Iranian TV about, and this is where I may be misunderstanding, made a comment about moderate Muslims conforming to Western society, and I'm paraphrasing, and he refers to them as Uncle Toms, and your guest seems to say, well, everybody vetted this guy and they're okay with his comments. All right, that's fine. In the same breath, though, your guest is against Donald Trump, which is also fine in and of itself. But the comments that Donald Trump had made about Muslim immigrants, not just, I mean, the Muslim refugees and wanting to halt that program until those people can be properly vetted, it seems that that particular caveat is left out of the discussion. So it just seems that, I mean, I would think someone would want to make sure, I welcome any refugees that come here that are fleeing their country and all that, but yes, I do want them to be properly vetted. I welcome any immigrant to come here, so long as they come here legally. But it just seems that when Mayor Khan over there makes a comment, your guest is kind of okay with giving him a pass about something that I would think is kind of controversial, but then over here, we're not discussing what the details were of what Donald Trump said as it relates to the settlement, if you will, of Syrian refugees and other folks, and that's the group that he had wanted to temporarily stop.
All right, thanks. That's Mark in St. Augustine. Thanks, Mark.
Well, Mark, first, appreciate your comment. I did not give him a pass. I did not know exactly what he said, in what context he said it. And that's why I said I did not want to comment on his comment. I just wanted to leave it at the way the election played out, because that comment was part of the campaign against him. Now, on the issue of immigration, if Donald Trump had said that he wants to temporarily halt the process of bringing Syrian refugees into the country, that would be one thing. It would still be problematic, but it will be still one thing that we can thoughtfully discuss. The fact, as I mentioned before, the resettlement of refugees in this country is the longest immigration process anybody has to endure. It takes 18 months to 2 years to go through the process with multiple government agencies doing checks on their background. Can that process be improved? Absolutely. That's always open for discussion. But you do not have to improve the process by stopping all immigration. You can do it at the same time. But if in doing a review of that immigration process, there is a determination that the process needs to be halted until certain checks and balances or fixes can be put into place, by all means. But he did not talk about that. He talked about, his statement said he wants to ban all Muslims coming into this country, not
including the new mayor of, well, no, he said the new mayor of London, he said, would have, there'd be an exception made for him.
Well, so he'll have a list of 1.6 billion people and go down that list and check off who he wants to give exception to, who he doesn't want to give exception to. By the way, by his logic, my parents would be banned from coming to this country to visit me. Or visit their grandchildren.
Yeah, it's not a realist. Let's just be frank.
It's just not realistic.
It's not a realistic proposal, but we do have a lot of calls. And by the way, Brenda emailed the show. I work at a local refugee agency, and my experience contradicts the caller's view that Iraqis and Afghanis are uneducated. They are very educated and quickly integrate successfully. Okay, thanks for that email, Brenda. Let's go to Ed in Orange Park. Hey, Ed. Good morning.
Yes, always a wonderful show. I think it's a wonderful thing. It shows how so many countries in the West are able to accept and adapt people of all kinds of religions and points of view in the world, as long as they do it peacefully and legally. It would be even more impressive when we will see a Christian elected as the mayor of a major city in a majority Muslim country, which would be really big news. I think you also need to understand this. There's a lot of concern with everybody, not just Christians, but Hindus, Buddhists, atheists, over the belief that seems to be popular according to all the polls of the people who, and of course not the majority, but a large percentage who believe in things like if you change religion from becoming a Muslim to something else, they have to be killed. Or that the fact that you need, what, two witnesses of women witnesses to equal the one male, and that kind of belief that seems to be a large percentage popular with the Muslim population in many places and of the Muslim leaders. Yeah. That's what's concerning to people, which is understandable. It would be hopefully the same concern if we hear Christian leaders saying that if you change from Christianity to Islam, you have to be executed. That would be wrong, too.
Okay.
So I wonder what your comments are.
Thanks, Ed.
No, I agree. I completely agree with the caller that, you know, it would be a great thing to see a person who is a Christian or a Jew or a Hindu elected a mayor or president of a Muslim-majority country or a society. But I think the Western world in the last 100-150 years have led in this idea of progressivism and enlightenment.
And multiculturalism.
And multiculturalism.
And separation of church and state.
And separation of church and state.
All of that.
So the fact that we are modeling it, not just saying it in London and in other places, will, I hope, at some point have a contagion effect in other Muslim-majority countries. Then the last comment about blasphemy or apostasy, I would agree with the caller that I would be appalled to see somebody holding those views that if somebody changes their religion from Islam to somebody else, that they deserve to be killed. That is one interpretation of the religious text, but there are many other people who also interpret those texts by saying that's not the right interpretation of the text, including myself. I have read through those texts, and I completely disagree that apostasy or blasphemy leads to a death sentence.
Jonathan, that's good to hear. Jonathan in Riverside. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to voice some concern. You know, I don't find it surprising that London's new mayor would call Donald Trump stupid. While it's a little bit blunt.
Actually, it was the Paris mayor. Voicing... Yeah, the mayor of Paris, who's a woman, she's the one who said that. But go ahead.
Apologies, right. So I just don't think it's surprising that the international community and its leaders would voice some unconcern or disconcern with Donald Trump becoming president after his repeated sexist, racist, and frankly asinine comments throughout this campaign. And he's getting pushback from the international community, from our own political establishment, and from the public abroad. In regards to those comments, I don't find that surprising at all. I'll take my comment offline.
Okay. All right. And again, just playing devil's advocate. Obviously, a lot of voters agree with Jonathan. A lot of it, when you look at the poll, though, here in Florida that came out just the other day, tighter than a drum in Florida when voters are asked, will you support Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? Obviously, Bernie Sanders won a primary just the other night, but let's assume Hillary Clinton becomes a Democratic nominee. Tighter than it can be in Florida. Half the state is saying right now they will support Mr. Trump.
Well, it's a 50-50 election anyway, because we are a 50-50 country politically. So every election is going to be tough. But just regards to that poll, I also want to take a little bit. I'm not a person who likes to unskew poll or look at polls and dismiss them because every poll is its own data point by itself. But that particular poll that showed a very tight race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in Florida, I do have a little bit problem with that poll because it undercounted the minority vote in that poll. If you look at electorate data going back, I think, 10 or 20 years, more than that probably, that the share of minority vote increases almost by a percentage point every major presidential election cycle. So I think the minority vote in 2016 will be higher than the minority vote in 2012. And in that particular poll, it showed that the minority vote was higher than what it was in 2012. So when you factor that in, but nonetheless, it's a data point. I don't want to be dismissive of this, but we are 5 months away from the election. It is too early to be putting any stock by any side on any one poll. It's going to be a close election, as pretty much every presidential election has been.
Always good to see you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Melissa.
Dr. Parvez Ahmed with us, and much more still ahead on the program. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
Want economic redevelopment? You gotta play the long game.
I believe that this Be Local hiring is a commitment that truly will change our community for a long time.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Think locally, act locally. We'll have that and the numbers from Wall Street as well next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Amy Robach, news anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, will be this year's afternoon keynote speaker at Girls Day Out, September 17, 2016, Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Amy is also a breast cancer awareness advocate and author of My Breast Cancer Journey, From Fighter to Thriver. For more information or for tickets, log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
A new debate on campus sexual assault, whether to list a suspension or expulsion on the perpetrator's transcript. Some advocates say it's a safety precaution if the offender should stay or transfer.
How are we protecting students if we're letting perpetrators in?
While others say it brands people for life.
I think at some point Hester Prynne gets to take the scarlet letter off.
Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, Baptist Health and Baptist Heart Specialists are providing comprehensive, minimally invasive treatments for conditions that impact valves of the heart. It's at their brand new valve clinic. And their new structural heart director is overseeing it all. She's Dr. Ruby Sapathy, and she's working wonders for local heart patients. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
And you come to Jacksonville from Nebraska, which is a nice change, I would think, weather-wise. So welcome to the community.
Thank you.
And this is an exciting advance for Baptist Medical Center, Jacksonville, with the mitral clip therapy. This is a minimally invasive catheter-based procedure. Can you tell us about it and how it's making a difference for local patients?
Sure. So mitral clip is actually a catheter-based surgery for mitral valve regurgitation that we can treat MR or mitral regurgitation with a little clip and bring the leaflets together and reduce the regurgitation. Recovery is day and night compared to open heart surgery. People usually go home in a day or two and back to, you know, their normal activities. We have 92-year-old dancing in their Easter egg hunt 3 days after surgery. So that's a big difference.
Sure. And in fact, patients are reporting that it's as though they have a brand new life. This is an incredibly dramatic before and after, isn't it?
Absolutely. They feel significantly better, less short of breath, and they can continue to do what they wanted to do, much better quality of life.
The technology behind this sounds really fascinating. You use real-time imaging to guide the catheter and clip right into the heart. That is like science fiction. I mean, how does that even work?
So it's actually very fascinating. I do a lot of complex structural heart procedure, which are basically minimally invasive surgeries to fix different conditions. And to me, mitral clip is the most fascinating and most complex surgery when we take a catheter and clip this. Again, I try to keep it simple when I'm describing the patients, but it's much more complex, obviously, looking into three-dimensional where we're going right at the pathology, and again, you know, manipulating your 24 French catheter into the left atrium and going towards the mitral valve. But again, if everything is done right and appropriately, fantastic results, yeah. And again, I have done this for I don't know, 4 years now since the inception of this. I was a part of the research trial as well.
Wow. And over the all around the world, overseas, tens of thousands of people have been treated with this. Here in the U.S., it's still a relatively new procedure.
Yeah, FDA approved this in 2013, so you're absolutely right. We did Everest trial 5 years before 2013, which led to FDA approval. Outside the United States, a lot more people.
We've got a call for Dr. Sapathy. It is Paul in Jacksonville. He's got a story about his heart surgery. Hey, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa. Excellent topic. 3 years ago, going on four now, March of 2013, I went to the doctor, and he had a chest x-ray and said my heart was enlarged and sent me down to have a stress test. And they found that, you know, four of my heart arteries had major blockage, and the doctor came and told me that, I don't know why you're still alive. So my question is, they put in four stents, and I feel fine. My question is, you know, how do you know, or how would I know, since I was asymptomatic, how would I know in the future that I might need additional stents put into my heart?
Yeah, thanks for that, Paul. Thanks so much, doctor.
Good morning, Paul. And I think the biggest thing what I would say is go by your symptoms. And did you have any symptoms before last stress?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I lost the call. But okay. But he needs to monitor his symptoms.
So I think you need to monitor your symptoms, make sure you don't have any chest pain, shortness of breath, and at the first onset of any symptoms that's different from your normal activities, I would recommend contacting your, you know, cardiologist and sooner than later so we can do a stress test. You do not need any routine stress test. I get that question a lot. You don't need it. It doesn't add anything.
And who else is a candidate here in our area for mitral clip surgery?
So people who are not good surgical candidates, which mean in a lot, you know, elderly people. And the definition of elderly can change depending on how, you know, how many comorbidities you have and how frail you are and your source of life. So bottom line, anybody that is not a good candidate for open heart surgery is very, very easily and appropriately served or better served with a mitral clip therapy.
It is a wondrous advance here for medical care in our area, and we're so pleased to welcome you to the studio. Thanks, Dr. Sapathy, for sharing this with our listeners.
Thank you, Melissa.
She's Dr. Ruby Sapathy, director of the Valve Clinic and a structural heart director with Baptist Health and Baptist Heart Specialists. And we will be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, how jails have become a warehouse for people too poor to post bail, and why these people often grow even poorer while in jail, in part because many jails charge for room and board and other services. We'll talk with Nancy Fishman, Project Director for the Center on Sentencing and Correction at the Vera Institute of Justice. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Spend some time in the Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT invites you to vote for your favorite submission. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about the Square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Coming up on the next reveal.
They said that there was some allegations put forth against me.
Tracy Griesbaum was a successful coach with no reason to think her job was at stake, but she was fired.
And I asked, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? And I was never told what I did wrong.
A national trend where female coaches are forced out on the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, during our long, bombastic election season, it can be easy to forget the real people behind the issues. Our occasional commentator Jay Solomon takes a story from the headlines in today's With All Due Respect.
The life of Alfredo, a young illegal immigrant, hangs by a rope. Working a welding job in Fresno, California, he falls 18 feet into an empty petroleum tank. Co-workers toss a rope. Struggling to the top, he reaches for a hand above, but fumes overcome him. He falls back into the tank, later saying his life flashed before his eyes. A tough life. Age 5, the youngest of 6 kids growing up near Mexicali, Mexico, his first job is selling food to truck drivers. Despite poor circumstances, Alfredo, always a go-getter, excels at school, earning a teacher certificate by age 18. He wants more, a career so he can help his family. Ranking risking his life over staying in Mexico, Alfredo, at 19, without any money or knowledge of English, heads for extended family in Fresno. Immediately caught jumping the border fence and promptly sent back, he tries again later that same day and succeeds. Then come 2 years living in squalid conditions while picking cotton, painting, and welding. Working the fields one day, he tells a cousin he wants to go to school, learn English, and have a better life. The cousin says, "This is your life, to work the fields." Undeterred, Alfredo goes to school and learns English. He tutors Spanish-speaking students in math and science while enhancing his English skills on the debate team. He takes the welding job to pay his way, and then, April 14, 1989, he falls into that petro tank. Some good luck, a hospital intensive care unit is nearby. Alfredo stays with the welding job for 3 more years, finally, happily, leaving for a scholarship at the University of California, Berkeley. His slow mastery of English threatens his grades, but his aptitude for math and science excels. Mentors turn Alfredo's interest toward psychology and neurobiology. After doing his thesis on neuroscience, he applies to and is accepted by Harvard Medical School. While earning many research fellowships and academic honors, he also earns the title U.S. citizen. Fast forward, and Alfredo, full name Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa, becomes a neurosurgeon and is now widely known as Dr. Q. His many other titles include Director of the Brain Tumor Surgery Program at Johns Hopkins Medical Center, Baltimore. When he's not operating or teaching, he's in the lab looking for a way to use natural stem cells in the brain to halt the spread of cancer cells in the brain. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Q is leaving Johns Hopkins this fall and heading here to the Mayo Clinic as chairman of neurologic surgery, the focus eradicating brain tumors. A story from Hollywood? Maybe. Disney and Brad Pitt are developing a biopic called Dr. Q. Just think, if we had built a border wall years ago, we could have kept out Dr. Q. But perhaps it's not too late to block others who have aspirations that won't wait. We can't have open borders, but hello, Congress. We must have intelligent immigration policy. With all due respect, I'm Jay Solomon.
Jay Solomon is a retired broadcast executive and WJCT volunteer. And we'll be right back.
Flight attendants are sick a lot because it's kind of like a kindergarten teacher. You're exposed to a lot of germs, mainly because I'm taking garbage from everyone, you know, and saying thank you for it. Thank you. Thank you for your garbage.
Join us for the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live, from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, coal mining companies in Appalachia have been steadily laying off workers and closing down. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders promised to bring new economic opportunities to the area. Donald Trump says he can revive the industry. Competing visions for America's coal workers and the future of the region.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
This Going Green segment is brought to you by the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jacksonville.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's a new chapter for Jacksonville's Kummer Museum. You might have heard about that Formosan termite infestation at the old Woman's Club building in Riverside next to the Cummer. Unfortunately, that means the Woman's Club building will have to be demolished. But the good news is something new will go up in its place. Hope McMath runs the Cummer Museum, and she joins us now. It's today's Going Green. Good morning.
Good morning.
And let's begin with the bad news. You had been planning to renovate that old building, a beautiful old building, and then you discovered something nobody wants to discover, Formosan termites.
Yeah, that's right. We had great and grand plans when we purchased that building about a decade ago to renovate it and turn it into a public programming space to further the museum's mission, and had finished the exterior renovations several years back. And as we were getting ready to pick that project up again, discovered what was at the time, we thought, just sort of your normal run-of-the-mill termite situation, and certainly learned that it was something much, much more serious than that.
And unfortunately, this type of termite is almost impossible to eradicate. And even when you do, it's my understanding that they can always come back. People have learned this the hard way. So you made a difficult decision.
Yeah, we have not. The museum staff and board have not taken this decision lightly. And we spent almost 10 months doing the due diligence and bringing in experts and scientists to help us even understand what a Formosan termite was, how to deal with the infestation itself, and how to prevent further infestations. And we also talked to colleagues and communities across the country, in particular the Southeast, that have been dealing with similar situations. And there are ways to get in front of it, but once you have a serious infestation, there are often losses of buildings. And we've seen that in New Orleans and Charleston and Miami-Dade County, and now we're seeing it in Jacksonville.
So what's the plan for the site?
So we have a process, obviously, to go through in decommissioning the current building because it is a historic structure. So we're working with people both locally and on the state level to help us with that process over the coming months. Obviously, our efforts have been in trying to save the building, so now we're going to turn our efforts into how do we continue to expand the mission of the Cummer, knowing that that particular set of bricks and mortar isn't going to be part of that plan. Mm-hmm. And so talking about a new building, talking about expanding our ability to show our collection, exhibitions, and do public programming around arts, gardens, and education is now our goal. And so we're excited that we are going to continue to move forward.
You'll demolish that site eventually. And then what do you envision going up in its place?
Well, you know, we're excited to get into the planning, the detailed planning for that. But we still need a space. And so we will be doing some deep dives with some really smart and creative people over the coming weeks to really put that plan together. But the purpose of the old Women's Club building for us still remains the same. And so once we're able to clear that site, continue to work on mitigating the infestation that is across our campus, we will then building a new building. And I can guarantee you that building will be absolutely built so that a Formosan can never enter
never
it.
Never get in. And I know you're concerned. The Cummer Gardens have these beautiful old oak trees. I know there's concern about those trees and even buildings surrounding the museum property. For that aspect of this issue, how is that being addressed?
So with Formosan termites, it's the size of their colony that is the biggest issue, and they're subterranean. So we do know that we have expansive colonies throughout our campus, and we know that they've actually been throughout our neighborhood. When we found our infestation, we learned that there were two others along Riverside Avenue that just had not gone public with those infestations. Formosans also love to nest in and eat oak trees.
Oh.
So we have several trees that are experiencing some infestation. We are treating those the best that we can and doing everything we can to save them. And the future of those particular trees is still in question. But the big Cummer oak along the St. John's River is okay.
That's the good news.
That is good news.
Any advice for people that maybe live in an old wooden property? And you've had a real trial by fire with this. It's just been, I'm sure, very stressful. And as you get out through the other side, it's been an education, I think, for the community about how these infestations can affect a property.
Well, you're right. And we're having conversations with other partners, Riverside Avondale Preservation, and including city council members about educational opportunities in the coming weeks and months. I think people really being aware of these, making sure that they are bringing professionals out to look at their own properties, to make sure they are asking the tough questions and not just accepting a standard diagnosis of termites, because a Formosan is very different and requires different treatment and requires different prevention measures. University of Florida is really the national leading experts on this, and they have resources available that we certainly have tapped into, and those are available to the broader public. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have asked, well, you know, what about your termite bond? Well, you know, the Cummer Museum was a property that was never eligible for a termite bond as a just a high-risk property, but that's not always the case. I mean, there are homeowners and small businesses that can make sure they've got their termite bonds up to date, that they do not exclude Formosans, which many do, and that they update their prevention measures to deal specifically with Formosans, because you don't want them to get in your building.
Fascinating topic, and we thank you so much for sharing this with us, and keep us posted.
We will. Thank you.
She's Hope McMath of the Cummer Museum of Art and Gardens. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. Never miss a show. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, or watch our segments video on demand at our partner TVJax.com. Next on Die and Ream, coal mining companies in Appalachia have been laying off workers and closing down. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders say they'll bring new opportunities to the area. Donald Trump says he can revive the industry. Competing visions for America's coal workers and the future of that region. That's coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.